Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, they will tailor a quote to your exact needs, saving you money on your annual bike, moped and scooter insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. Also, and listen up, please, this coming Friday, the 22nd of November, we're going to be live on stage at Motorcycle Live at the NEC in Birmingham with our very special guest, Titch Cormack. If you can make it down, then please come, see us, say hello, as we'll be on stage between 11 and 11.30. That's Motorcycle Live at the NEC this Friday, the 22nd of November.
I can't wait. That's going to be absolutely brilliant, as is today's podcast, because we have got an absolute belter of a guest. Let me tell you, he is a legend, not just on two wheels, on four wheels. You'll know him as a motorcycle racer, a truck racer, an author, a TV presenter, a commentator, a pilot, and probably the best prankster I've ever met. He is the one and only, the brilliant Steve Parrish. Morning, Steve.
Good morning to you. Are you all right? Good.
We're good.
You're up now, haven't you, with all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, no pressure, Steve, to deliver, which, of course, you always do.
But I have grown up a little bit now. I'm not quite as immature. My wife thinks I've grown up to about 14 now.
Well, you're in good company here, Steve. Don't you worry about that. When you look, I mean, just as Ewan's reeled off there, when you look back on your career, I mean, it's been sensational in motorsport and bikes, obviously, especially. There must be a real sense of contentment as you look back, but obviously with half an eye looking forward as well.
Yeah, I think so. We all love what we've achieved and we all love the times that we've had. I'm constantly being told, and I think I'm probably going to believe it, that I lived through the good times of motorsport, I guess you'd say. My career really pretty much started off more or less mid-late 70s. When you could do lots of silly things and get away with it, you didn't get photographed because you had to carry your box brownie around or whatever it was. You didn't have a phone, you didn't have X or Twitter or Facebook or Instagram and all those sort of things. So, and even the journalists, I think back then, what went on tour, stayed on tour. So we could, muck around a fair bit. And I think it was when sport was probably quite a lot of fun. I certainly made it fun. Whereas I often think now, and I still love it, and I'm sure you guys do, but particularly in my sport, motorcycle racing and maybe car racing, you become a bit of a homogenised being, and you have to do the right thing, be seen to do the right thing. You have your psychiatrist with you, your dietitian with you, and all the things that I didn't do. We kind of raced on Saturdays and Sundays and then pissed around the rest of the week, really. And that was what it was about. So I came through that period, and I've seen it grow and change a great deal. But yeah, you're right. I'm very proud of what I did. I've still got aches and pains and screws and pins to prove that I did it. And so I'm kind of now thinking that the doctors are right and you'll regret it in later life. But who would have thought I'd live to this age?
Yeah, no regrets, mate. I think you've done it the right way. You've excelled at sport and you've done it with rock and roll pizzazz as well. And I think you're right. Sport and athletes today, they just seem manufactured. You know, they've got the right answers. They've got the correct things they have to say. Whereas in the day, you could have a cigarette hanging out your mouth if you wanted. You could say what you wanted. You know, it was different. You were you. But in terms of two wheels, a lot of people we talk to on here, we ask them, where did it start? Where did that love affair start? And normally it's, oh, my dad got me into it, or my uncle got me into it. Was it always two wheels for you at a young age, or was it going to be cars?
No, it could have been anything. It didn't matter what it was. I grew up in, near to where I'm back living again now, in Hertfordshire on the Harts-Cams border, and there was a disused airfield called Steeple Morden. It was an old wartime airfield, and it had runways, or some of the runways were left there, and there was fields and everything else. And I would drive or ride anything that cost £5, because that was about all I could afford. And I would have been from the age of maybe 10, 11, 12, 13, all that sort of era. I'd go up there with maybe an uncle would give me an old banger of a car, or I'd find one from the garage that had been no MOT or whatever. And I learned to fix it and drive it and cause havoc around there, really. None of the other parents in the village would let their kids come anywhere near me, because I'd seeing how many times I could roll it over on the airfield or something, you know. And just same with motorbikes. If a BSA Bantam or a James or something came along that was £5, and I could get it going. And I had a couple of mates that would come along, Fortunately, the son of the fellow that owned the village garage, because he could nick the petrol, so that would help a lot. And we'd just tear around on anything, and whatever it was. So, and it just happened to go motorcycling because I had one when I was 16. You were allowed to have one at 16. I'm not even sure what it is now. I think it maybe is. But you could have a little up to 250cc. And that was my only more way of escapism, really. Living in the villages, there was no buses or anything else around. So it was my independence. So got myself a little 250 Yamaha YDS3, which I've actually bought one back, and I've got one in my store. And that gave me a chance to tear around. And I met people that rode motorbikes, as you did back then. And I think there was more people rode motorbikes back then simply because it was a cheap way of transport. You know, you could do it, and your insurance came to 10 quid and your tax was 5 quid or whatever.
Wow.
And off you went, and I passed my test after a week and then got a bigger bike and just loved it. But the mates I met in the village pub, none of us liked snooker, darts, football, rugby or anything else, but we liked motorbikes. So fairly early on, we decided we were going to go racing, and I couldn't. There was a bloke that could weld, there was a bloke that could do paint spraying, there was someone else that could do sign writing, and I really couldn't do anything apart from ride. So I got the job riding, and that's really how the team started as such. And by then we were about 18, so yeah, 18 or so, saved up a few quid, got an old bike, and I was the riders. We were known as Porous Racing because we were as poor as piss, and the bike used to leak so much oil. So that was
a twofer. I like it. I like it. Not just a good rider, but a great pun as well.
Yeah. I guess if I'd have met up with people that race cars or whatever was in car racing, then probably I would have gone that way. And I genuinely think, and I've been told it, I probably would have been as good at the same level, whether it be four wheels or two wheels. It just kind of whatever. I love just driving, riding, going fast. Loved scaring myself, still do. My wife hates it.
We can certainly relate to that thrill-based element of what it is. And you mentioned, Steve, you mentioned teammates and mates and moving forward with racing. Am I right in thinking that Barry Sheen was a real hero of yours? And then you take that into account and then you kind of jump forward a little bit and you talk about rubbing shoulders. That must have been kind of dream come true territory.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you have to pinch yourself, don't you? And you look back on it. And now I look back on it more and more. Right place, right time, right age, right skill base, I guess. I had a poster on my wall, and you were saying about you speak to people, what inspired them to go riding, and it was their mum or their dad or whatever, someone in the family. But me, it was Barry Sheen. And I was 3 and a bit years younger than Barry. He started racing before I did. Everybody I knew wanted to be Barry Sheen if you're a bloke, and if you're a girl, you wanted to be with Barry Sheen. You know, it was like that was the way it was. So he was the poster boy on my wall, along with others, I guess, Agostini and Mike Hailwood and famous people like that. And then eventually, yeah, quite astonishingly, having won domestic racing, British Championships and things, I got to meet Barry before I joined the team. He lived at the time not far from here, Wisbeach in Cambridgeshire at the time. And we hit it off straight away. We like fast things and girls and fags and generally having lots of fun. I got the call in the winter of 1976 from Maurice Knight from Suzuki's offering me the job of joining him as teammate, which was... And I guess I deserved it because his teammates at the time were two other British riders, which was John Williams and John Newbold. Tragically, they both got killed, as lots did back then. And I was managing to beat them. I couldn't beat Barry Sheen in the UK because he kept winning and I was finishing second and thirds, but in front of his teammates. So that was how the opportunity arose. My first ever trip on an aeroplane was going to the Venezuelan Grand Prix in 1977. Talk about wet behind the ears.
That was your first trip on an aeroplane? You were going over to Venezuela?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. British Caledonian out of Gatwick to Venezuela. And really just a chance to get on a big aeroplane, really, yeah. Quite phenomenal, really.
And what was that like then, but not just becoming friends with, but becoming teammates with someone who was your hero? I mean, I know it's hard to compare because bikes are different, circuits are different, the whole sport has changed. But modern days, people will look at, you know, the doctor, Valentino Rossi's got to be the greatest. But I'm sure you'll argue Barry Sheen was right up there. If you can compare him to modern day riders, how good was he?
Yeah, you're right. He was... he was very, very good. And I think he would admit, and I would definitely say, Barry Sheen was not the fastest rider ever of that era, but he was the most consistent, the most solid. He was smart. He was able to get the right engineers, the right tyres. He was good at putting the package together, which I think we could all say about Valentino Rossi. There was people that came along and were faster than Rossi on a day. And I could mention one or two, but not many won as many world championships. And Barry was that smart lad that knew everyone, got to know everyone. He was happy talking to the dustman or to the MP of the local town or something like that. He could just transition from different people, got the best out of everyone, and was really good at what he did. So, yeah, to become his teammate, I mean, that was... I'd talk to people, what do you do for a living? You know, well, I race motorbikes. Oh, well, you know, are you on dirt? And you just go, Barry Sheen. Oh, right, got it. And I'm sure in the latter area, there'd be other people that were racing motorbikes and you'd be talking to someone. I'll be MotoGP. Well, what's that? Valentino Rossi. So he was the key word, really, at the time and stayed that way for a long, long time in the UK. And we've had some great champions in the UK, but I'm pretty sure if you get stopped by an elder policeman, they'd go, who do you think you are? Barry Sheen, wouldn't they? Because we've had some great, you know, British riders. We've got Jake Dixon now, we've had Cal Crutchlow and all those people, but they weren't really household names like Barry Sheen was.
It fascinates me to listen to you talk because of the generational span that we're talking about here. And me coming from a footballing background, there's always debates about current players against former players, could Maradona be as good in this era as Cristiano Ronaldo? Would Bobby Charlton cut the mustard in the Premier League? And obviously, generationally, there's the younger people that kind of go, who? And you go, well, let me fill you in on who that is. and that way of looking at a different generation through the eyes now, because I presume, and you absolutely are the expert in this, and you tell me absolutely correctly, that we're talking about machines that have advanced beyond comprehension in some degrees, different safety measurements. We'll talk about the TT in due course. And your racing career and what you were doing and the equipment that you were wearing, the helmets that you wore, all that stuff has taken quantum leaps forward, hasn't it? So generationally, you can quite easily sit there and go, do you know what? We were doing things in a way that would be deemed infinitely less safe than what they're doing now, and getting up, cracking on with it. Is there a way to kind of compare? Can you compare a Rossi to a Sheen? Can you talk about your career in the sense of speaking to someone that's racing right now and get that understanding?
Yeah, a great question. And the answer is no, I don't think you can, because there is so many factors. What I would do, and you spoke about the safety side of it, there is no way any of the modern day riders would ever ride around what we did, because we were riding around ridiculously dangerous places. I did a book about 4 or 5 years ago, and I counted up something like 27 mates, people that close friends that I raced with that all didn't make it. Really, that many. And you know, I can think of 5, 6, in fact, 3 teammates. It just goes on, because we were racing in ridiculously dangerous times. Now, you think, well, why were you doing that? It was madness. But you have to remember that the bloke going to work was probably driving to work in his Ford Anglia that had a metal dashboard. And if that didn't kill you, the steering column stabbed you. You know, life was dangerous. So I think, you know, everyone was smoking fags, didn't know it was dangerous for you. I wasn't wearing hearing defenders, and so I'm deaf. And, you know, you just went through that period where it was normal. It was wrong, but it was normal. And, yeah, the gloves I were wearing, I might as well be wearing golf gloves, you know, and the boots were like Wellingtons. Everything was very, very dangerous.
But, Steve, saying that, you know, you've listed a number of good friends of yours that you've lost, so you knew the dangers. Did you ever get to a start line? You're on the grid. Did you actually fear for your life and think, hang on, I love what I do, but this is dangerous? Or were you of the belief, I've got the skill set, I know what I'm doing, I can read the weather, read the track, I'm good at this, I'm safe? Did you know how dangerous it was?
Yeah, I did, but I didn't accept it. It was always, oh, well, he was, you know, like you'd make up some reason why the person fell off or crashed or whatever. You know, he was looking for it, he was going crazy, he'd got the wrong tyres on, or just a bit of luck. But I don't know if I believed in my skills. I believed in my luck, really, because I had just as many crashes as I could mention. John Williams, John Newbold, Dave Potter, Mark Sal, you know, it goes on and on. And they just, unfortunately, probably hit something solid, which I just glanced off of. And I had some big, big crashes. But I think at the end of the day, I was probably one of the lucky ones. And, you know, there's a few of us old blokes still around, Mick Grant, John Cooper, people like that, that did make it through. But it was the only time I think I probably questioned my sanity was going to the TT. And you said, that's come on to it. But you would get on that ferry with your mechanic and your girlfriend or whatever it was in your van, and you drive across there with 2 bikes in the back, and you've got 2 weeks going round there. And you would know pretty much that about two people weren't coming home. That was the average on that one event. So that was the one place where I think I treated it with a bit more caution maybe than I did anywhere else. But that's why I never won the TT. I got on the podium, but I didn't win it because people like Joey Dunlop and some of the other riders from that era were hell-bent on winning the TT. I wasn't. I wanted to go there because I got paid to do it, and I wanted to do the kind of achievement of doing it, climbing Mount Everest or whatever. It was the biggest thrill and scare, and I have to say I loved doing it. But boy, was the relief when you got on the ferry to go home.
I think you've been quoted as saying, have you not, that you only ever gave it 80%.
Yeah,
full beans on the TT because of that factor. Any regrets there that you didn't actually push it to the limits?
Yeah, I don't know if there's any regrets because I'm still here talking to you. Now, whether or not I'd given it the 90%, maybe I wouldn't. I always made a point of, if I wasn't too sure of the speed of the corner, I'd be 10 mile an hour slower than instead of being 10 mile an hour faster. And I rode at the pace I wanted to ride around there. And there would be people coming past me in conditions that were foggy or rainy or whatever. And I'd just say, well, that's it, you know, go on and win the race. So it wasn't the be-all and end-all. For me, it was Grand Prix short circuits. That was really what I was after. And relatively speaking, I know it sounds daft, but Brands Hatch, Alton Park, places like that were much safer than the TT, even though they had Armco barriers and sleepers around them. There was less of a chance of a dog running out, or I had a sheep flipping run out in front of me in the Isle of Man, rabbit, you know, all sorts of things that go on out there. Don't get me wrong, I love the place and I still go there, and I'll be going there come next June. But you have to accept that if you want to win the TT, you've got to put your neck on the line. And everyone knows it when they go out there because there is a choice. But just quickly going back, 77, my first year doing Grand Prix, was the first year that the TT wasn't a world championship race. From 1949 to 1976, if you wanted to win the world championship, you pretty much had to go to the TT, which was very wrong because it was not fair for a Spanish, Italian, German, Austrian guy to come out and have to learn 37 and three-quarter miles of the TT circuit to have a chance of getting the points, which were the same as going to Silverstone or Germany or France and places like that. So it was right when it lost its world championship status, and it survived, and it's still probably just as strong as it was. So I didn't go there because I was chasing world championships. I went there because I was invited to go by the organisers and my sponsors. Suzuki's wanted me to go there, and Yamaha, when I rode for them, wanted me to go there. So you're under a little bit of pressure, but not something that you couldn't say, I'm not doing it.
Do you think then, Steve, given your take on the TT and what it's such a thrill, and I've yet to go there in person, it's definitely one that we want to tick off as well on the podcast, but watching it and seeing it and listening to the thrill of what it is, the fact that there are people that go on the ferry one way and don't come back, do you think we'll ever be in the realms where collectively or from a governance point of view, people say you can't do the TT, you can't do the Northwest 200 because people are dying, even though it's obviously no one's forced to do it, no one's pushed into going into the TT, everyone elects to go into, and everyone that we've spoken to, we've had some wonderful people on here like yourself that talk about what it's like to do it and how they love to do it. Would that ever get taken out the rider's hands, saying it might be more of a ceremonial or a processional? You can go around, but no one's doing 125 miles an hour, you know what I mean? Everyone's got to slow down, got to absolutely sanitize the life out of it, because then therefore that would make it not what it is, would it?
Sure. No, I think you're possibly right. I hope you're not. But yeah, I do think that it could eventually run out of steam. The only reason probably the TT goes on now is that it's supported by the government. Obviously, we all know that the Isle of Man government's older than the British government, and they sanction it, they want it, it's good for their GDP, it's got everything going for it, the Isle of Man's known for it. But yeah, maybe one day someone in there will say, we can't be doing this. I don't really know. The Northwest 200 is slightly different than some of the other Irish races. They've already, I'm probably sure you're aware, they struggle with insurances. Can you imagine? I think the Isle of Man is underwritten by the Isle of Man government for its insurance purposes. But just imagine if you're an underwriter, you're going to write Bill, here we are. We're going to set off from this point here and Glen over the traffic lights at St Ninian's, they're doing about 160, 165, still accelerating down the bottom to the bend at the bottom at Brayhill. There'll be people, Mrs Miggins will have a cup of tea and a ham. She'll be there with cousins and auntie standing in the garden. And then you'll go up the hill there and you'll brush that hedge on Aggo's Leap there, and there'll be another group of people watching there with their sandwiches. You'd just walk away, wouldn't you? You really would.
Yeah.
You can't imagine. The world you live in now, you've got to be careful that one of the pavements isn't sticking up and someone trips over it. So we are living in this ridiculous world now where no one can do anything dangerous. So there is a possibility. I don't know when and if, but the Isle of Man at times doesn't make sense, but it is, and you've been told this before, the most exhilarating, ridiculous, nonsensical thing you could ever do. And if you haven't been, get there quickly, I would suggest, because who knows, 5 years time it might not be there.
Yeah, we got to get there.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Got to get there. Just with regards to racing, Stephen, as we've said, we've had some wonderful races on over the course of the couple of series we've done. I mean, Toseland, Hickey, James Hilliard, the names just jump out. And we spoke to James about retiring through injury, which, again, there's still a real seed of what if with him, even though he did so wonderfully well. But the ones that are still racing or getting to the point where it's time to call it a day, with your experience of that, to call it a day before you can't do it anymore, to be able to do it on your own terms, and obviously your career then blossoms in a different direction after blossoming on the racetrack. What is it easy to get to that point where you say, right, that's it, I'm done? Or is it something that comes to you rather than you making that decision?
Well, I think it comes to you if you get injured enough, you physically can't do it anymore. But no, I think it's a huge problem for everyone. And I'm sure it's the same in your sport. And we all go through that period. Let's face it, if you can make a living out of your hobby, it's a dream come true. You know, the day that you have to think about going to do it, then it's not as much fun. So, and I do often genuinely feel sorry for some of the people that do, their career does come to an end. And it might be because they're not fast enough. It might be because they haven't got the sponsorship. It might be because they've got an injury. A number of factors can come into it. And John McGuinness is a great example, I guess. Well, he's 52, I think, now. John is still enjoying it. And I saw he wrote a column the other day, while I'm still going around there, he can run top six or seven, I'll carry on doing it. Now, John's in probably a slightly different position because he's, I'd say, financially secure, and he's got a period now to go on being an ambassador for the sport and whatever. But if you've not quite made it to that level, very difficult to stop, because you've spent arguably 20, 30 years doing something like racing motorcycles, and that could be playing football, rugby, whatever. Your skill set isn't as good as the bloke that left school when you did, went to college and has got a business set up, or he's got a really good job, and he's got all that experience. You're kind of thrown out in the deep end in lots of ways. You know, I'm very, very fortunate because I stopped racing in 1986 at the age of 32. Already had a team ready to set up. I was sponsored by Yamaha and Loctite. Did that for 5 years. Started doing a bit of commentary work. Then truck racing came along, and then more commentary work. So I've managed to bumble my way through my whole life, keeping out of a proper job, and I'm very proud of that.
you've done well, mate. I think what's hard as well is if it's running through your veins, which it is, and like you said, it's a passion, it's everything. When that's taken away, it's absolutely horrible. But listen, jumping all over the place, I spoke earlier about your rock and roll lifestyle. Earlier in your career, did you not get sponsored by George Harrison from the Beatles? Is that right? Was how did that come about, and how cool is that?
Yeah, it was pretty cool, I have to say. Well, like most things in my life, a lot of them were instigated by Barry Sheen, because he was the man that knew everybody and did everything and whatever, and he'd open a lot of doors very, very easily. But what happened was, at the end of 1977, I finished fifth in the World Championship, which for my first year I was very pleased with. I'd never seen any of the circuits. As I said, I'd not been on an aeroplane before. So I got really stuck in. I got given Barry's bike from 76. So I had a one-year-old bike and he had the new bike. But we had some good battles together. Anyway, at the end of 77, Suzuki Japan decided they hadn't got a budget to run three riders in 1978. The team in 77 was myself, Barry Sheen and Pat Hennen, an American. And Pat ended up third in the World Championship. It was his third season doing Grand Prix. And I was obviously fifth, so I was the one that was dropped off. And Barry was really pissed off because he wanted me to stay in the team because we were mates. And George Harrison had been coming to some of the races. And I got to meet George and Livy, his lovely wife. And George comes up one day and just said, oh, don't worry, Stavros, my nickname. A lot of people won't know that, but Barry Sheen nicknamed me Stavros quickly because when I was young, I was fat and I had curly hair and I looked like Stavros out of Kojak. So that's quickly where that came from. So he said, George said, oh, don't worry, Stavros, I'll buy you some petrol and some tyres and bits and pieces and so on and so on. And he gave me this address. Go down to Cadogan Square, I think it was in London, where his record company was, and it was Harry Songs Limited and Dark Horse Records. He had two record labels. And I walked in there and this lady gave me an envelope, and in it was a cheque for about 40,000 quid. And in 1978, £40,000 was a lot of money. It bought me two RG500s, a TZ750 Yamaha, you name it.
It's a lot of money now. It's a week's worth for props when he was playing for Southampton.
Yeah. But it's a bonus for scoring. But anyway, it was enough to set me up. And then on top of that, luckily, a company called CSS that looked after Barry's management had got a skateboard company that wanted to get involved with Barry, and he couldn't put that name on the bike, so they got involved with me. So 1978, I was kicked out of the factory team and earned about three times more than I did. George was a lovely, lovely fellow. We'd go down to his house, Friar Park at Henley, and go to his recording studios and get involved with all that and meet all the lovely, famous people that were around. And so, yeah, it was a great, great time.
That's absolutely amazing. I mean, that's blowing my mind. Because I remember reading, like I said, a Beatles nut, and it was his love for kind of racing was very much in direct contrast with all of his kind of... Eastern kind of religious faith and the belief, wasn't it, with regards to what he was, peace loving and all that type of stuff. And then he was a bit of a petrol head underneath it all, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was mad on F1. He used to go all the F1 races. In fact, I remember he organised Barry to have a test in an F1 in the Surtees. And George actually got to drive the car as well at Brands Hatch. He went round in the F1 car as well. I remember doing a couple of events with him for charity, the Gunnar Nielsen Cancer Fund. And George would come along and we'd all have to bomb around Silverstone in Porsches and raise money and things like that. But yeah, it was a bit rock and roll. There's no doubt about it, because there was all these famous people turning up at the races. And it was 1977, sex, drugs and rock and roll was what the 70s were about.
That was it, wasn't it? Yeah, 77, the spirit of punk and all that. I've got a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping amidst all this rock and roll chat. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. And coming off the back of what we spoke about with George Harrison, truck racing, absolutely fascinating, Steve. Where does that come from in this mad story that's just full of randomness?
Yeah, well, again, Barry Sheen, I'm afraid to say. Well, not afraid to say. He was the man that kind of sorted out lots of things for me. But I was jealous of Barry because he, in his latter years of racing motorcycles, 84, he was sponsored by DAF Trucks. He had a Suzuki in blue and yellow colours, and right on the back of the seat was DAF Trucks. And it was something that DAF wanted to get involved with. They supplied his transporter, which is a great big DAF truck. And then all of a sudden, truck racing turned up in the UK. It was something that had been going on in Europe for a season or two. Not so much in America. Everyone thinks truck racing came from America, but the type of truck racing we did, which was European trucks mainly, was started off in Germany, I think it was, or something. Anyway, the multi-park truck Grand Prix took place at Donington Park, and I think I'm right in saying it was 1985. Mike Smith, remember him, Radio 1 DJ?
Yes.
Right, yeah. Mike Smith was into it big style because he was racing cars, I think, at the time. And it was called the Multipart Truck Grand Prix. And it was advertised all the time on Radio 2 or 1 or whatever Mike Smith was on, and he was going to drive. They've got Martin Brundle driving a Renault truck and Stig Blomqvist, a rally driver. Anyway, all these people, and Barry Sheen was going to drive a DAF. I was really pissed off because I'm not blowing my own trumpet here. Barry Sheen was better than me on a motorbike, no question about it. But whenever we raced cars, and we did a lot of celebrity car racing, I used to beat him. So there's me chomping at the bit. I want to go racing trucks. So I went to Mercedes-Benz at Milton Keynes. Said, Barry Sheen's in a DAF. Give me a Mercedes and I'll beat him and whatever. And they did. I mean, they said, you've got an HGV. I said, yeah, of course I have. I've never driven anything bigger than a Transit. And the initial trucks were just road trucks. Just to go back to the multi-part truck Grand Prix in 1985 at Donington Park, was the biggest crowd they've ever had, bigger than the Formula One race that was up there and everything. It was like 120,000 people. The M1 was shut. It was just ridiculous, monstrous. Anyway, I did this race and finished second, beating Barry, beating just about everyone apart from some Italian bloke. And I just looked at all these people and it was like, ka-ching, you know, when the old pound signs come up in your eyes, and I'm going, I think I better have some of this. So I did my best to continue doing it, which I did. Mercedes-Benz UK built me a better truck because they could also see the opportunity in promoting truck racing and trucks in general. And I went off to Germany and I beat all the German factory drivers for Mercedes-Benz. Signed a contract in 2000 and would have been 2001, I guess, something like that. No, it was earlier than that. I don't know. Anyway, around that time, and a full factory contract with Mercedes-Benz, which was exactly the same as the DTM drivers were getting and everything else. And
wow.
It was great. And I didn't go to hospital much. That was the best bit.
You got a cage to protect you in a truck.
Yeah.
Do you have to pinch yourself sometimes, mate? Do you think, you know, you were that young little lad on the Hertfordshire borders as a kid, knocking about on some dodgy old bikes and cars, and then you've made a really good career, like not just blowing smoke up your ass, but not just as a racer and a driver, but as a commentator, pundit, presenter. But in terms of when you look back now at everything you've done, do you have to pinch yourself and think, how have I made a living out of this for such a long time? It's brilliant.
Yeah, no, I do. Absolutely. I'm a very lucky person. As I said, I think you start off, if you make a living out of your hobby, then you're very lucky. But I do still miss, and Dave was saying there, I do still miss the adrenaline. I really do. I'm 71 years old now, and it's ridiculous that I still like kind of scaring myself a bit and doing things that I shouldn't be doing. And that's very hard to get rid of. And I'm sure that comes from any sportsman, really. The accolade that you perhaps get and the satisfaction that you get from achieving something. And it's a hard thing to get rid of. But unfortunately, I'm getting so old, I'm not going to be able to do it much longer. So I've managed to drift down the line, and I still get a kick out of winning a game of tennis and a game of golf and the things that go on, and a bit of Goodwood and so on and so on. But yeah, I've been very, very lucky. And yes, I'd love to have won a world championship. I won a few British championships. I won 5 truck world championships, actually. But I'd love to have got better at the kind of pinnacle of my career, which is motorcycle racing. But I keep saying to myself, you know, I'm here, I'm talking about it, I've had a lovely time doing it. And it's an old cliche, but there's one bit I'm going to add to it. When one door shuts, another one opens. But the key is keep the corridor short. And I've kept...
I've never heard that. Yeah. I've never heard
keep
that.
Keep the corridor short. I've walked out of one door into another one pretty quickly. And yeah, it's been absolutely great. But I'm very lucky. I've got a great wife now. Second time around. First one wasn't so good. I put the wedding video on backwards from the first one. I'm watching the car piss off.
Watch you legging it out. Steve, I mean, do you still ride now?
Yeah,
obviously,
I do.
You talked about having bikes and tinkering around with them, but I presume it's as much about getting out and enjoying what it is to go and ride a bike as much as it is being able to fix them and tinker with them.
I'm not so keen on, I don't really ride a bike to go places on the road so much. Apart from that's not true. I do. I ride a bike to the airport. We have a house in Mallorca and a boat out there. So I just got back 2 days ago. So I go to the airports quite a lot. I went to Italy for the EICMA show last week for the presentation of Suzuki's and things. So I take a bike to the airport, but I wouldn't say I'm someone that would just go for a ride around so much. But I still get on the track a fair bit. I do some work, track day stuff and promotions and activities, Goodwoods. Did South Africa at the beginning this year where they have the classic TT. So I still ride on the track a fair bit. Take me painkiller for my dodgy knees and things like that. But I love getting out on the track still on, and particularly old bikes.
What's the reaction like, Steve? Like, obviously you take your helmet off, people know who you are, but with the greatest respect, as you've mentioned here, you take your helmet off and there's a 71-year-old fella there that's been terrorising around the track. Because, oh my God.
I know, especially when you go past some young kid or something and kind of still showing what's going on, it deflates them just a little bit. But there's a lovely fella called Steve Wheatman who owns a big collection of motorcycles, mainly Suzuki's. He runs a Suzuki Classic team, and he has a couple of bikes very, very similar to what I raced in the 70s and 80s, RG500s. And he kindly lets me use those when we go to events. So it's always very nice. I've got 3 of my old RGs in my gym round the corner here, but they never come out because Steve Wheatman's got some that come with a mechanic and they mend them if I break them. So I have got too many bikes. My wife wants me to start selling.
How many?
14. Yeah, at the moment, yeah.
14?
Yeah. They're all old classics mainly. I haven't got any modern bikes. They're all kind of RG500s, TD2, Yamahas. And
nice.
No modern ones at all?
No. The most modern bike I own, actually, it's a scooter. And this will, people will laugh at that, but it's a lovely Kymco 550 scooter, which I also can pass most people on their superbike.
Brilliant. Steve, bearing in mind you've ridden some amazing bikes and you said you love classics, you've also, you know, have the privilege, I've no doubt, of riding so many brilliant modern bikes. Can you pick a favourite? Any bike, not necessarily that you've owned, the bike that you've ridden and you've got off it and gone, wow, that is a special bit of kit.
Yeah, I'm going to really annoy most people now because I've got to ride Valentino Rossi's M1 Yamaha in 2013.
Oh my word.
In fact, back when I was working for the BBC, when they covered MotoGP, at the end of the year, certain journalists, if you'd been like ex-riders or you kind of were able to ride a proper bike, we would get to test all the MotoGP bikes. So I got to ride Danny Pedrosa's Honda, Yamaha from Rossi, Lauris Caparossi's Ducati, all those MotoGP bikes. And the M1 Yamaha that Rossi was riding at the time, 2012-13, was just, just sublime, I guess you'd say. It was around Valencia and it just did everything you could ever expect a motorcycle to ever do. But bearing in mind, that was 10 years ago now, wasn't it? So more, 2013, we're 24 now. So can you imagine? I've never ridden one now. I mean, I just can't imagine what they must be like now when they're... That bike I rode, I think, was 260 horsepower. They're now 320.
With all due respect, that you were 60 years old still then.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a 60-year-old man tearing it up on the most powerful performance bike in the world. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's probably the best bike I've ever ridden. It made an R1 Yamaha seem like a step-through scooter, really. You know?
The fascinating thing with this is, because, again, forgive me for trying to, and you and I'll have a take on this from an athletics point of view. So this, it's akin to, I don't know, someone like obviously Martin Tyler, but without obviously him playing football for a living before becoming a commentator. It's akin to him kind of scoring an overhead kick. It's like, Martin, go and play football for a bit. And like, Steve, you put the mic down. I'm just going to take this for a quick lap. And everyone's going, well, he'll obviously know what he's doing. And then you do it. And I could just imagine them watching it in the truck or the director or the producer and going, Jesus Christ.
A lot of the mechanics back then, there'd be Jerry Burgess was working on the bike and some of the lads that kind of were my age and getting up. And, you know, it'd just be nice coming and go, Timmy, you still got it. You know, you're about 3 seconds a lap slower or whatever, but you've got 3 or 4 seconds a lap slower. But, it's a real treat to have done things like that. And I got to drive a Formula One car when I was racing trucks at Hockenheim because Mercedes used to bring all the toys out and like Coulthard would ever go in the truck and I'd go in his car. And then they'd have Fangio's 1930 whatever car out and you're bobbing around in this big old Mercedes from 1930 that's worth £2 million. And so I've been very fortunate, yeah.
People say living the dream. You have definitely lived the dream, my friend. Wow.
Swapping toys. I love that. David, I'll just take your F1 car around. You take this big, massive Merc truck.
Yeah, and then have a day with the DTM car and all things like that. So I have, yeah. You're right. I've lived the dream, yeah.
You talk about living the dream and, I mean, all of it's been fascinating, Steve. It's been, I mean... There's a great, again, we've had so many wonderful people on here, but for sheer randomness, mate, you're very much up there.
Well, you've not had many that told you, see, I've managed to...
they're still here to tell the tale. That's a wonderful thing. It's your little short corridor, which I'm going to absolutely take forward and use that from here on in. But
last time I saw you and when I was working with you, you just bought your C63, I think. I knew it.
That's gone now. Have you still got yours?
No.
I spoke to you about it. Yeah.
Pass anything but a petrol station, wouldn't it?
Yeah. That's great, but I need to keep stopping. Right, we're into final question time, Stephen. It's a fantasy question that we put forward to you, which is your best and kind of favourite ride. So we're going for your where you're going, we're going for what you're riding on, and we're going who are you with and what's on the soundtrack for your fantasy motorcycle ride.
Wow, where am I going? I'll probably go at the TT, I guess. I'm riding up to the TT. Would you say, who am I riding with?
What are you riding?
It's got to be Rossi's bike,
I've
surely.
I've managed to nick Rossi's bike, yeah, because my RG500 would have run out of fuel by the time I get to I guess. So, yeah, I've nicked Rossi's M1 and put some number plates on it, some dodgy number plates, Pen 15 or whatever it was.
You're going, who are you riding with?
And I've got Barry Sheen beside me.
Nice, and
we're having a right good cruise up there, then we'll get to the TT and we'll stand at in the governor's viewing area at the TT with a large gin and tonic and watch the people go around there. I guess that's exactly would be my dream weekend. Yeah,
that sounds absolutely so. I did say it was your final question, but you've just poked my curiosity there when you say about Barry Sheen, and we spoke about him at length earlier on. Is there a top tail or a top scrape that you both got into that you could tell us just to round off?
I can't
this side of legality.
I can't tell top ones, but I could probably tell you one or two other ones where we've got into the odd scrape here, there, and everywhere. But a story that most people do enjoy, which is very true. I'd moved, I was still with my first wife, actually, and we'd moved to a farm in a village called Ashwell. And Barry used to come down and visit sometimes. In fact, in latter years, he'd come and land his helicopter in my garden or whatever, but he drove down on this occasion, and he'd swapped his rolls in from Mercedes 450 SLC, I think it was, I can't remember. But anyway, he played a prank on me, so I thought I'd get him back. And he came in, he was having a cup of coffee, and I said, oh, I've got to go, someone's at the door, and this, that, and the other. And he'd left the keys to his Merc on the side, and I'd nicked his key and wound the passenger's window down on this Merc. And then I've still got some in my garage now. It sounds pathetic, but I've always got a bag of broken glass. You get it off of auto. And I've tipped all glass on the seat, of course, on the passenger seat, and put a brick on top of it. So we go outside. Sure enough, there's his nice new Merc with a rock on a load of broken glass and no window. So I managed to lend him a load of polythene, and we taped it all up. Took about half an hour to tape it all up because he had to drive Charwood near Gatwick with his Merc. So he's ordered his new windscreen from Auto Windshields, delivered it round the next day, and they've just put the door panel wound down.
That is so good. Oh, man.
I love the commitment to it as well, helping him tape it up.
Yeah, that's so good.
I can't believe they've done it.
Apologise all the time, you know. So, so sorry. Couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Oh, Steve, I've got to say, in terms of guests, I know I've said it, who've lived a life and are still here to tell the tales. You, my friend, are brilliant at telling the tales. And honestly, it's been a pleasure, isn't it, Prats? Because we've really wanted to get you on here for a while. And it's just to hear your stories, talking of yesteryear, it's lovely.
My venture next year, I don't know if you know him at all, I'm doing, I did 10 years of my own theatre show called The Mad Tour, but I'm starting off with Henry Cole. So I'm doing some stuff with Henry Cole.
Oh, nice.
My word, that'll be some do that.
20 dates around the country next year in theatres, 300 or 400 seaters, and bombing around doing that. So I'm looking forward.
Fantastic, Steve. Oh, we'll pencil a date in, won't we? Yeah, 100%. Get ourselves there. Out of the two of you, I mean, will there be room for any silence at all? Because you're both talkers.
Not, because he can. He's got more rabbit than Sainsbury's. There's no question about it. But interesting life, if you don't know much about him. Henry went to Eton, was in the same class as Boris Johnson. Went on to be great at doing what he's doing, and he's mad on doing motorbikes and find it, fix it, flog it, and shed and buried and everything.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun doing it with him. So
I'll certainly keep an eye out for that. But sadly, that's about it for this week's Full Chat, powered, of course, by Bikeshaw. It's the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your annual bike, scooter, or moped insurance.
I told you at the beginning of this, it was going to be an absolute belter. I have to say, thank you so much. By far, one of my favourite guests, the one and only Mr. Steve Parrish. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure.
It's been our pleasure, Steve. Don't worry about that. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode. Or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. And don't forget, I said at the top, to come and see us at Motorcycle Live at the NEC this Friday, the 22nd of November, when we'll be on stage from 11 till 11:30 with the brilliant Titch Cormack.
Yeah, thanks so much for listening. If you can pop along on Friday, we look forward to meeting you then. If not, we'll see you next time. Thanks.